Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, taking you on a journey to the darker side of humanity once again, as we explore the deranged mind of infamous serial killer Robert Christian Hansen, otherwise known as the Butcher Baker. From 1971 to 1983, the trophy-winning hunter unleashed his venomous rage on at least 17 women by kidnapping them and flying the prospective victims deep into the Alaskan wilderness, where he would release these terrified people with a head start and then hunt them like wild game with his favorite rifle and a large knife. Given his skills, resources, and knowledge of the terrain, the result was inevitable. After making the kill, he'd take the body back to the sandbar where he parked the plane, bury it in a shallow grave, and leave no other evidence in his wake before leaving the scene. It was seemingly the perfect plan, especially given that most of his victims were prostitutes and other transient types that frequently disappeared without a trace from the Anchorage area where he lived during the 1970s. This come-and-go lifestyle for sex workers in the region at the time was heavily spawned by the influx of people involved in construction of the 800-mile Trans-Alaska oil pipeline, an $8 billion project that utilized 20,000 workers in an effort to keep a frenzied pace that would complete the project within 3 years. They accomplished that goal. So the project not only drew a lot of people toward the region in search of work, whether that profession was related specifically to the pipeline's construction, or even services for employees temporarily living in the region, whether we're talking about housing, restaurants, or even paid sex, but also left many of them wandering the state like ghosts in the aftermath. In addition to that, Alaska also experienced an influx of men during the Cold War, many of whom were seeking to avoid the fallout of potential nuclear conflict. So there was a boom in population during this era, and crime rose with the influx of people looking to cash in on the deal, from pipeline workers to nightclub owners to exotic dancers who doubled as prostitutes. It was a frontier town, to say the least. It had a Wild West feel where things were just starting to happen, and the law wasn't in place to handle the circumstances quite yet. Which, in this case, aside from the deaths of the unfortunate victims, is a very good thing, because the crimes of Robert Christian Hansen are going to require FBI intervention to solve the mystery, and that will lead to the utilization of advanced criminal profiling. It allows authorities to build a psychological model of the specific type of person who would commit such crimes. If done correctly, it can be eerily accurate, even down to the nuances of predicting certain physical traits, profession, and habits, among other things. Now, what drew me to this case is the specific type of criminal Butcher Baker came to be over the course of many years committing various crimes. He starts his career in his youth by engaging what are commonly considered antisocial behaviors, such as theft, arson, and similar offenses, before graduating to kidnapping, rape, and ultimately, murder. Throw a dash of torture on top, and what you have is a very scary individual who avoided detection and capture for quite a long time because he didn't fit the mold of a killer by way of perception. But the content of his character was highlighted by a cold heart and no soul. We're going to look at a man who was capable of maniacal narcissism and cruelty. Yet what I find so intriguing is that, while no serial killer is ever able to achieve his goals to satisfaction, including Butcher Baker, he does manage to accomplish something quite significant that others who desire the same couldn't accommodate. And that's the fact that Robert Hansen ascended from the ranks of being a sociopath in his younger days to being a psychopath in his adulthood. Now, I know there are differing feelings about what these things are and what defines them, so I'll just move forward based on what I think. Anyhow, before we examine his backstory and trajectory into darkness, I'll elaborate on the importance of such a thing. The sociopath normally aspires to be a psychopath because the psychopath is the dominant of these two psychological dispositions. For instance, somebody who shoplifts on a regular basis while being able to easily afford the items in question could be considered a sociopath. What makes it the submissive of the two behaviors is that it's a lower percentage play. You're trying to take something in the absence of offering resources to buy it. Now, you could also be a vicious rapist and murderer like Ted Bundy, and also simply be a sociopath, but you still make low percentage plays. Yes, Ted manages to separately kidnap two women from the same park on the same day, but also gets turned down repeatedly by other girls and women in the process. He has to manipulate to convince others by way of false perception, just like the shoplifter. It's because the sociopath has no interest in extending resources to others. In fact, the sociopath is often short of resources, a bottom feeder who wants to take everything and give nothing. The psychopath, however, is interested in only one thing: control. Contrary to the con artist type of manipulative behavior the sociopath offers, a psychopath is more likely to be an ambitious personality, someone who desires his own vast resources as a means of manipulating others. For that reason, psychopaths are usually people like Butcher Baker, who ran a successful bakery, and John Wayne Gacy, a well-known contractor who worked a side gig as a clown. Another great example of a psychopath is the Iceman, the ruthless mob hitman who killed so many people it's a wonder he was ever able to remember half of them. He killed for money. He had no guilty conscience whatsoever. It was his job, his business. He supported his family that way, by disposing of people. He did this for a very long time, and not once did he think it was a bad idea. So, whereas somebody like Scott Peterson doesn't want to work, and decides he's going to gain control through manipulation by murdering his wife and collecting the insurance money, lying to everyone in his path, the psychopath goes right to the source with his own resources and makes high percentage plays through decisive measures. In this case, we'll see Robert Hansen guarantee himself victims with decisive or skillful actions involving guns and money. Gacy got most of his victims by offering employment to young men who couldn't otherwise earn such wages as laborers. He was able to do that because he was a smart businessman. So, the three psychopaths I've mentioned utilize a high level of skill and a great deal of resources in their plight. The sociopath has to be a snake in the grass because he's always trying to take resources. The point for him is to not part with them. All of which is to say the psychopathic personality relentlessly seeks control, and does so without any regard for other people. The psychopath is not a leech. He doesn't hope for others to act in a manner that benefits him. He makes it happen. The character of the Terminator, from the movie of the same name, a role played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, perfectly encapsulated the plight of the sociopath. He relentlessly attempted to acquire resources in order to locate, control, and kill the people who were his targets. He would stop at nothing. And this was portrayed perfectly by literally making him a cyborg, which has a human exterior, but is a machine beneath the facade. It's truly brilliant. In fact, director James Cameron understood this truth so well that he knew he could bring this character back for the sequel and have a monster hit on his hands before even attempting to make part two. The reason is the mirrored image of the psychology, the other side of the coin. In part two, Schwarzenegger reprises his role as the Terminator, only this time, using that mirrored psychological image, his relentless skills are put to use to protect the mother and son he was sent to kill in part one. So whereas he's a frightening psychopath bent on killing in part one, the sequel paints him like a father figure, someone entirely unwilling to allow this woman and child to be hurt, even if it costs him his life. And it does. The fucking Terminator dies. It's incredibly moving, too. This cyborg you watched annihilate innocent human beings throughout part one brings tears to your eyes as his own shut at the end of Terminator 2. Even the people he hunted are crying. The movie grossed a ridiculous amount of money, so disproportionate to the first film, you'd think it couldn't be possible. Critics and audiences attributed this to special effects and a good script, but the centerpiece in all of that raw emotion was the transformation of the Terminator as he went from being symbolic of the worst type of man we know to the best. We love when people change. Hollywood has made a fortune on this concept because change is beautiful, it's courageous, dynamic, and moves like the wind. It's freedom, plain and simple. However, the psychopath does not change or relent. He controls. That's Robert Hansen. But here's where the story in The Terminator comes full circle, as does my purpose for mentioning a Hollywood film. In line with what I've discussed in recent episodes, I believe diverse types of brains, even those predisposed to evil behavior, are teaching us a tremendous amount about how to bridge the gap between humanity and artificial intelligence by allowing experimentation in nature. We conduct endless studies about cognitive function that will ultimately produce the cumulative knowledge required to make the transition a reality. What we see with mentally disabled, mentally unstable, and/or potentially violent people in today's society is that their brains are researched for a future where we're going to have to deal with such anomalies in relation to artificial intelligence. In accordance with shows like Westworld, which was just as relevant as a movie almost 50 years ago, our machines are going to go haywire and kill us. Some people write that off as baseless, but it's been happening since humanity started creating machines. Cars malfunction, planes crash, boats sink, roller coasters go off the tracks. The list goes on and on. But this is the point of it all. The paranoia is derived from an obvious question embedded in the psychology. If we make machines that are superior to us, will they eliminate humanity? Yes. That's evolution. But it won't be the result of malfunction, as you see in entertainment such as Westworld or Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, where the ship's computer, HAL, suddenly decided he wanted to be in charge. What you notice in those two offerings is that, while the fear is the malfunction, the root cause of the malfunction is human error. By default, the robot is superior. As an extension of that, evolution says it should eliminate humanity. Yet, the fact remains the robots are still faulty and unreliable. We can't let them win. Yet. So in the TV shows and films, we still win in the end most of the time, because the technology just isn't good enough. It's really this simple. When the technology gets good enough that we can create superior machines, we won't be able to stop them, and nature will be forced to allow them free passage to make us obsolete. Anyhow, where the Terminator ties into this discussion again is in the disparity between how we see this half-human, half-machine cyborg at the start of the first Terminator as opposed to the end of the second. At the start of the first, he arrives on the scene as a nude man. There's no indication he's actually a machine. Yet he doesn't seem vulnerable in any way. In fact, he begins stalking three men nearby in an effort to take their clothes, determined to kill the trio if they refuse. Of course, they mouth off to him, and he dispatches of this crew in moments with mind-blowing strength. That doesn't seem human either. Yet we still see nothing but a man. When he speaks, he doesn't sound human either. But again, he looks it. Though we're still unwilling to believe. Because he's relentless. He kills without conscience. And shows no remorse. He's powerful. Unstoppable. Omnipotent. And how did he get there? He was teleported from the future. And what we learn is that the future is full of machines, including human-like artificial intelligence, that are hell-bent on destroying humanity. Just like Westworld, it indulges our fears about a future absent of humanity. Notice it takes place in the Wild West, on a frontier. The symbolism apparent is we're headed for that unpredictable future where there's no going back. Right now it seems possible to stop the momentum. But what's important to note about these faulty machines is that our specific concern is that they will become psychopaths. That's an irrational fear, however, because it's based in the notion that they have no soul. Yet the soul, while it's practical for religious and spiritual purposes, is a product of perception, not physicality. Therefore, we won't have any problem creating machines with personalities and desires, as these things result from a variety of factors. So notice, then, that after the first Terminator film, in which a period of years passed before the sequel, James Cameron realized what I'm talking to you about right now. The machines aren't going to be accidental psychopaths. The logic is flawed. And how does he correct the issue? He kills that ideology in T2. Schwarzenegger comes back as a cyborg relentlessly intent upon protecting those he previously wanted to kill in the first film because the ideology was ridiculous. But that doesn't erase his mistake. He still has to kill the ideology in favor of one that makes more sense. So he brings in another cyborg to try to kill the same people who were in danger in the first movie. This one is symbolic of the faulty ideology. And then, as he attacks them, the combined efforts of humans and Schwarzenegger's reformed, heroic cyborg save the day together. But we all still know his face. We remember he was a psychopath in the first film. He's part of the ideology, so he has to die too. Though it's ironic because he saved the day. In that light, Cameron gives the Terminator a frightening but honorable death. He slowly sinks into a fiery pit where he's consumed by the overwhelming heat. It's almost as though he's descending to hell. But the people he tried to kill, and then helped, are crying as they watch this. They're mourning the death of their ideology, and specifically for this reason. It means humanity loses the war against machines. But the irony is this. It's not because the machines are evil. They're just better. And as the Terminator's head starts to go under, the flesh melts from his face, and we see him as a machine. But that's when we realize something. He's never been more human. And we see the crying people, leading us to realize that he is not only capable of inspiring the human brain, but showing love as well. He's everything we could have hoped for. And then he disappears. But the humans are left crying, pensive, alone. They survived, but only for today. They know what the future brings. Machines. The fact that cyborgs are used symbolizes the bridge between humanity and artificial intelligence, which is something we'll face in the not-so-distant future. So after rambling endlessly, the point of all that is the reality that the future is going to allow us to create artificial intelligence devoid of certain qualities based upon what we learn by examining abnormalities in human behavior today. In that light, Robert Christian Hansen was every bit the Terminator while killing. And if you examine the factors that led him to harbor so much anger that he needed to do these things to achieve release, what's revealed is that AI fixes most of them. The issues it can't repair could be managed in great depth through virtual reality. But we're not there yet. So let's start back in 1939 Iowa upon Butcher Baker's birth. Now, we don't even get a few sentences into this one before hitting a snag in this guy's development. I had just mentioned in the last episode that trying to make the left-hander right-handed is ridiculous, but that's what happens to Robert Hansen. Right from the start, his father Chris notices his son is developing the tendencies of a left-handed person, so he spends years beating it into the kid's head that he has to conform to being right-handed. His mother joins in on the fun as well. The problem with this is that those things are connected to brain function, and telling a person being left-handed is unacceptable leaves an indelible impression upon the brain that there's some sort of irreconcilable issue. The elder Hansen will even go so far as to have his son perform tasks at his bakery solely with his right hand. Of course, anger builds in Robert because he's treated like an outcast for something physical he can't control. Remember that, as it becomes a pattern, one leading to murder. So the Hansen family is devoutly religious, and Robert had a very strict upbringing. Even as a boy, he worked long hours in the basement of his father's bakery, coming to resent the man for being isolated down there for so long. He reportedly said he felt alone and caged in. To make things worse, his father ridiculed him on a regular basis, further stifling his confidence and encouraging his severe stutter. As he spent most of these hours trapped in the bakery or at home with his domineering father, and also a mother who never resisted her husband's wishes, Robert never learned how to assert himself on a social level. He was a painfully shy, withdrawn kid who was teased by others at school, only to go to work in his father's bakery the rest of the time and be emotionally tormented by the angry man. Robert Hansen was powerless as a child. His father controlled everything, and his mother allowed it to happen, most likely due to her own fear of her husband. The end result, however, is that Robert is going to have issues with women, specifically in believing they're weak-minded and can be controlled, as evidenced by what his father was able to do to his mother. So as I've discussed in the past, many people suffering from mental illness, when unable to deal rationally with an emotional issue, will let it spill out onto a physical canvas. Depending upon the issue at hand, this can be very scary. If we examine Hansen's boyhood, specifically the years prior to reaching puberty, we see he had no control over his environment, whether at home, socially, or at work in the bakery. He was trapped inside these places, at the mercy of others' will. Robert Hansen was powerless as a child, trapped indoors all the time with people who hunted him down to berate him or mock his stutter. He was always running. They were always after him. But there was nowhere to go. He felt their wrath. So when he regurgitates this mirrored image of his pain, we're going to get someone who hunts others, running from him, in situations where they're trapped and going to feel his wrath no matter what they do. And it will happen in wide open spaces outdoors, with nobody else around, rather than confined to a school building with everybody watching him get humiliated. He'll always be the alpha male out there. He will never be the alpha male in society, though. So he extracts the prey he can't acquire by societal rules, through kidnapping, and brings them into the wilderness, where they'll see instantly that he's the top dog. So as Hansen moves from childhood into his early teen years, the acne gets really bad, and the stuttering follows suit. In fact, the stuttering continues to get worse because of how often he's teased. With the realization of his own sexuality, he began to approach girls, but soon found himself rejected. Before long, he grew to hate school, later claiming that being teased by girls had a terrible effect on him that led to his desire to kill. Now, we certainly can't excuse any of his future actions, but let's take a look at the reality of his life. He's in his teen years, and he struggles badly to make connections with other people. Now, Robert will go on to lose his virginity at age 18 to a prostitute. But otherwise, he goes straight through high school, never being the cool guy with the girlfriend. He's the butt of never-ending jokes about his acne and stutter. And he'll have a lot of time to think about that, to stew about it, while so many other teens are out at parties, dating, and having a great time. Robert won't be doing any of that. And he won't be having sex until he pays for it. Because of nature. Of course, I like to make observations about the prospective future of artificial intelligence in the context of all things true crime, because of cases like this. He can't change his face. He can't fix his stutter. And it's enormously tragic. First for him, and then for humanity, as he murders at least 17 women to compensate for the anger of having to live that way. He chose those actions, but the fact remains that he wouldn't be so angry or lonely if he could somehow fix his stutter and face. If he did those things, he'd be far more likely to find love and far less likely to have a reason to kill. We should remain cognizant of simplicity in such matters. Because Robert engaged exactly what we teach children to do on a regular basis. He struggled badly to socialize with others, so he established his identity by focusing on his strengths instead. He went into the woods, where he didn't need to socialize and wouldn't be a joke. He would be the alpha. It gave him incredible peace and solace at these times. But then it would hit him. Nobody was there to see how dominant he was, especially the attractive girls he desired at school. Many people point out that Butcher Baker didn't torture animals in his youth, like many serial killers do, but he killed plenty of them nonetheless. His interest was in the hunt, because that's where he was failing with girls, in that pursuit of the so-called prey. So he focused on other things. He actually set records as a hunter. But no matter how big the kills got, he still desired those women he couldn't have. If they didn't succumb to his desires, he'd hunt them. So in childhood, Robert experiences the onset of his own feelings of powerlessness. By adolescence, and due to failed sexual conquest, he's amending that list with stifling feelings of inadequacy. He graduates high school a virgin. Hansen then joins the Army Reserves and is sent to New Jersey, where he ultimately goes through a string of prostitutes before coming to this conclusion. He wants more control. He doesn't like these quickies with the prostitutes. At age 21, when he returns from the reserves, Hansen starts to engage in some dangerous sociopathic behaviors. He burns down the bus garage at the local school in an act that seemingly has no available motive. Robert didn't stand to gain anything by it. But this is actually just his version of torturing animals. Robert hated going to school, yet despite his pain about the past, it's gone. So he has to kill the idea of going to school in the form of the buses because everyone else has moved on. It's incredibly narcissistic and vengeful, but also very interesting. And who is his accomplice? A 16-year-old high school student. The third accomplice never showed, but he was also 16. Look who Robert is hanging out with at 21 years of age. High school kids. He's trying to get it all back. Anyhow, several of these buses are destroyed, and there's damage to 7 in total. The building is obviously damaged as well. So our friend gets 3 years in a reformatory. And he's right back to being lonely and powerless again. Without sex. When he's released, he manages to meet a woman and get married, although she isn't the type of attractive female he so greatly desired when he was rejected as a teen. So the inadequacy and powerlessness persist. He's even working for his domineering father again. He deals with these issues by stealing anything and everything he can get his hands on when walking into random stores. In fact, he once claimed he nearly ejaculated in his pants while stealing some items. Now, you'd think he's getting away with this, right? No, he gets caught repeatedly, but never faces criminal charges. That only bolsters his narcissism and feelings of omnipotence. However, his name becomes known. The police are often watching this guy because of his behavior. So he decides it's time for a fresh start elsewhere, and believes Alaska is the right place for this reason. Better hunting. And boy did he mean it. In addition to the 17 women he'll later kill, Hansen starts out his conquest in Alaska by setting multiple hunting records, with doll sheep and bears being his preferred targets. And while he seems to have settled into a quiet life with a wife and 2 children in Alaska, the sociopathic behaviors only continue. He gets $13,000 through an insurance scam, which allows him to open his own bakery. Right away, you can see his plight. He wants to become his father, and he wants all women to see it. Just like the way his mother said yes to his father's every desire and demand, even to the point of agreeing with every thought, he wants all women to say yes to him at every moment, to dominate them, to have them see him as the alpha male. But they won't. And they'll die for it. Hansen will later tell police that after he kidnapped most of these women, he would demand oral sex and other such things. Anyone who refused or gave him a problem would be flown into the outback, hunted like prey, and killed. Those who complied would be raped, sworn to silence, and released. It was about power. No woman he desired was going to say no to him again. He wouldn't be rejected. So Hansen finally breaks down and releases his rage in late 1971. First, he tries to kidnap a woman at gunpoint after making eye contact with her at a stop sign, but fails and gets arrested. The court sends him for psychiatric treatment, but he walks free of criminal charges. The next month, Hansen kidnaps and rapes an 18-year-old woman, but lets her go afterward. She presses charges, but Hansen's lawyer convinces the judge at trial that he should get counseling and work release. What's worse is the police find a dead young woman with her hands tied behind her back right near the spot where the 18-year-old claimed she was raped. So it's bad, obviously. We're talking about a man who's such a narcissist that he claimed in court that the woman he tried to kidnap and rape after seeing her at a stop sign was giving him permission to do so because she smiled at him. The legal system didn't seem to think this sociopath was a problem. They just let him walk. And that's when we know for sure that his killing spree goes into full swing. He told psychiatrists at the reformatory where he did time that he had fantasies about doing vicious things to the young women who rejected him. But a guy like this gets work release for committing an abduction and raping someone. It isn't a surprise, then, that Robert later admits that the same night he finished the work release program, he went to downtown Anchorage and thought about killing prostitutes. Hansen's also been prescribed psychiatric medications at this time, but he stops taking them. 30 women will be raped by the butcher baker by the time his spree is over. Many of them will lose their lives as well. Almost all of the women he killed were prostitutes or exotic dancers. He believed they deserved it, and they were the bad girls, while those such as the first two young women he raped were released for being good girls. What's going on here is that Hansen hates the prostitutes because he has to pay for sex in the absence of otherwise being able to get it from attractive women he desires. They represent his inadequacy. He's reminded of it every time he pays. So he doesn't pay. He takes it and becomes dominant. Over the next decade or so, he makes a habit of leaving bodies all over the Knik River region, just outside Anchorage, sometimes buried at the sandbar where he left the plane, and other times in the woods nearby. But Bob wasn't exactly a genius. He left shell casings from his crimes at the scene, even in the graves, and used the same rifle every time out. But that's not going to be his downfall, at least not in totality. Now, before we get into what led to his arrest, I want to reflect on the magnitude of the difference it would have made if Bob's childhood and adolescence hadn't been marred by those issues. I ask myself what I would have changed in my own life, because we all have those demons. We harbor grudges against what we are. It's a strange disposition, but all too real, because you didn't choose what you are. But technology is going to ease that emotional pain as the years pass. More and more, we can change what we don't like. Right now, it's things like breast implants, eye color, and if you're the most ridiculous guy at the gym, even calf implants too. You can inflate your lips and vacuum out your hips. It wasn't long ago that none of these things was possible. So it's clear that we want a future like this. It won't change the structure of evolution. People with more resources available to be superior to others will still have that privilege. But it will help us to not spend too much time looking in the rearview mirror. Humans waste immeasurable amounts of time thinking about the past. The bittersweet nature of the human lifespan preoccupies the brain to an extent it is simply not efficient. Scientists have been telling you for years what an amazing organ it is, but the reality of the situation is nearly everybody in the world is mentally ill, to one degree or another. Withering away to death like a flower, while possessing an intellect that relentlessly asks why, and fears it, is a science experiment gone wrong. We're going to create mind-blowing machines by negating so much of the bullshit that keeps us from focusing on what comes next. Think about what you love in stories. What's the only thing that matters in a story? What comes next? Redefining who we are through technology will redefine the concept and perception of time, relieving us all of a lot of misery. You won't be wondering how much time you have left until you die. When your battery is low, you might have to plug it in. That's it. By that time, you probably won't even have to do that. So as we wonder if these machines will come to kill us, we can also see that Robert Hansen already did that as a human. Men do it all the time. We're faulty. The male sex drive is disproportional to the need to procreate at this point in history. It was designed to be in high gear at all times, and for males to be larger and physically stronger, to ensure the survival of the species in the most primitive stages of our development, when a simple disease of some type could have ended humanity. Rapid explosion of population is the result of such a thing, and larger populations have proven to lend themselves to better technology, higher survival rates, and longer lives. Unfortunately, the fallout from this design is that the world has always had a strong rape culture, something that's boiling over in modern society and revealing itself as a problem that still runs rampant. It exists because there was a practical purpose for it in the earliest days of humanity, not for us, but for nature. Nature guarantees men will seek to procreate due to a high sex drive, but women could easily go on strike and refuse, thereby ending humanity. Of course, that's highly unlikely, but there has to be a deal breaker. That's scary. That's why the world is still the way it is. But technology is going to change that. Nature will not dictate who we are. We will. In fact, we'll be at the helm of her ship one day, too. We will not be products of evolution. We will control its path. Right now, we can only react within its influence and confine to our mortality. So I think the key to escaping so many of the social issues we discuss is immortality. As long as nature creates our children, we're going to be susceptible to perceived faults that can't be changed. Anger, despair, murder, rape, suicide, they all come from that primitive deep wound we all have about not having a choice in who we are. We can change our clothes. We can change our actions. We can even change gender now. But what we can never do is change the past, because it's human. Our lives are headed in a direction where our consciousness will no longer hold the pain of the past. It's a freedom so profound, I don't even know how to describe the weightlessness I feel when I think about it. We want the past to go away. There are no good memories, only good people and good times that are gone. That's the truth. They're never coming back. Evolution needs this to hurt. It needs this to be on your mind right now. And mine. Everybody in the world. Why should we die when we can live? Why look back when there is only forward? There's no reason to do these things in the future. But for now, we have Butcher Baker and his rage. Why is he mad? Because he can't reconcile the nature of who he is against the fact that he's mortal. He can't get these attractive girls to like him because of his stutter and acne. These feelings of powerlessness are exacerbated by his father's dominance over him and his mother. His mother will agree with anything his father says, but Robert can't even get a girl to talk to him. And his life passes by like this. He'll die unable to get their attention without kidnapping, raping, or killing them. They never have any interest in him. It's really sad and frightening because there are so many men who feel this way, right or wrong, and violence against women often ensues because of it. In truth, our reproductive process isn't appropriate to civilized society anymore. Men walk around like vampires looking at women with a creepy gaze. All day, every day. And the way society has tried to combat these things is to become more civil. But the issue with that moving forward into the future is that a significant portion of civility is bullshit. People pretend because it's worth it. 5 minutes on the internet will prove just about everybody is boiling beneath the circus act of niceties that we put on for the world every day to appear normal. Anyhow, after more than a decade of murder, rape, and kidnapping, Bob Hansen, the Butcher Baker, decides he's going to go big. And we can see the natural progression. This was coming due to his emotional issues stemming from his troubles with his father. He wants to get a woman into his home to do these terrible things to her. He's never been able to be the domineering man at home that his father was, so he sends his family away for a few days. Now, just to clarify, Hansen actually marries twice. The first marriage is short-lived, and the second woman is the one with whom he has 2 children and moves to Alaska. Obviously, he wasn't able to internalize the success of having a family and a business in a way that would negate the pain of his youth. He couldn't let go. So now, with the house to himself, and after more than a decade of killing, he's going to allow that emotional issue to manifest physically by trying to dominate a woman in his home. Of course, we already know what his downfall is going to be. Bob desires control to the extent of omnipotence, as his father had in their household growing up. When he says something, he expects the women to agree, comply, or submit, whichever is most appropriate. It's an environment riddled with fear and born of powerlessness and inadequacy. I think that's what's so scary. Nothing less than violence is going to get Robert Hansen what he wants. So, on June 13, 1983, Robert picks up 17-year-old Cindy Paulson, who works as an exotic dancer and is apparently also a prostitute. He offers her $200 to give him oral sex, but pulls a gun on her when she gets into the car. He drives her back to his house, where he chains her up in the living room and performs every sadistic act of torture or rape he can think of before taking a nap on the couch. Meanwhile, he has her chained down in the basement, by her neck, awaiting her fate when he wakes up. In the morning, he handcuffs her, puts her in the back seat of his car, and drives out to the airport. He tells her he's taking her out to his cabin, and proceeds to get the plane ready. Now, remember, what Hansen truly wants is nothing more than women to desire to be with him. So while Cindy is handcuffed, she's also not attached to anything. Some people would say that was stupid on Hansen's part, but it's actually fairly common among abductors to allow their victims an increasing amount of freedom while in their presence, because it provides a false perception that they actually want to be there. In fact, over time, some captives actually begin to comply and don't even require being watched. They don't leave. Hansen wants that type of situation, one where he can dominate and control an attractive woman who will see him as an alpha and want to remain with him. Now, that sounds really twisted, but his rage is also the equivalent of his pain. Anyhow, Cindy sees her chance to make a break from the parked car when Hansen has his back turned. She makes it across a field and out onto a street, where a truck driver sees her flagging him down with a handcuff dangling from her wrist. He stops, takes her to a hotel where her boyfriend is staying, and calls the police. Paulson is able to describe Hansen, the interior and location of his home, and his plane at the airport, among other things. So police check it out. But they find no evidence. Bob says she tried to extort him, that he did pick her up as a prostitute, so Hansen goes on about his business, and Paulson leaves town. This is when the FBI gets involved, and their profile of the killer matches Robert Christian Hansen, from the notion that he would be a business owner with low self-esteem, right down to the nuance that he would likely have a speech impediment. By October 1983, authorities have a warrant to search Hansen's home, in which they not only find souvenirs from his victims, such as Andrea Altieri's necklace, but also a map that clearly marks each one of his kills with a big X. This helped authorities identify the locations of the victims, and Hansen even showed them the way on several occasions as part of his plea deal. Of course, he couldn't receive a lesser penalty for such crimes, but asked for the stipulation that the story be kept out of the media. In the end, he gets 461 years in prison. He died in 2014. When arrested and forced to come clean, however, Hansen first blamed the women for what he did to them. It was their fault, for what he had suffered. And I cringe when I think about that. Because no woman ever deserves the wrath of somebody like Butcher Baker. At the same time, no innocent boy should have to grow up being ridiculed for something he can't control. It's terrible. But that's our world. And what we learn is this. We all grow up to be evil monsters. If you don't believe me, just consider the following statements in succession and gauge your emotional reaction to them. Feel free to substitute any gender you like. Right now, there's a baby boy looking in your window at you. Right now, there's a 5-year-old boy looking in your window at you. Right now, there's a 10-year-old boy looking in your window at you. Right now, there's a 14-year-old boy looking in your window at you. Right now, there's a 20-year-old man looking in your window at you. Right now, there's a 30-year-old man looking in your window at you. Right now, there's a 40-year-old man looking in your window at you. And so on. You could do that until the men are 1,000 years old. But the truth is this. It gets increasingly creepy as he ages. And for various reasons. But it does. What you see as he ages in front of that window is what he feels in your reaction. That's what Robert Christian Hansen experienced in life. Once he wasn't a baby anymore, women had no affinity for him. He stayed outside, becoming a creep. But that window was always there. That glass between him and them. He wanted to be in the comfort of that home, like so many other men. So he smashed the glass and broke through to the other side. Unfortunately, the window, that barrier, represents the civility of modern domesticity, a line we can't cross. That's what evil men hate. That line, that invisible barrier. It's like handcuffs. But going back to primitive society is evolutionary regression. We can't go there. For one reason. We already know too well that the past is not suitable for life. So I think what we learn in this case, and from ridiculous thoughts about the Terminator, is that the greatest gift humanity can ever bestow upon the world is to let go of the past, to move on, and embrace change by living in the moment. That's what we're always told to do. Our best life is lived right now, without fail. It's not just our job to find that type of existence within the framework of what we know. We have to be willing to take risks, and to understand that love transcends these flesh and blood bodies. With that, it shouldn't be difficult to see that the reason for death, whether it's mine, yours, or anybody else's, is to teach us that we need to shed these bodies. Love is eternal. That which loves is not. That's the tragedy of our universe. But within that irony is a beautiful truth. By avoiding thoughts of days gone by, and always moving forward, we create beautiful things we can leave behind for others when we're gone. And in that light, until we find a better solution, we forever live in a past that offers nothing but eternal peace and love. So what we understand at the end of that trail is that we leave this world with nothing, and all that will matter is what we've left for others. If we die this way, I simply can't believe we should live any differently. Robert Hansen's life was defined by what he took, but he was still powerless. The lesson is this. At your lowest moment, when it seems the world has taken everything from you, and your mind crumbles, the only way out is this question. What else can I give? That's your power in this world. That which you create. So get out there and let your light shine. I promise they'll see it.